This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Robert Morley, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, and today's host for Trumpet Hour, Joel Hilliker, is out of town, but don't worry, he'll be back. He'll be in for Wednesday's show. Thank you for listening in today. We have a great program. Let me begin by introducing our panel. These gentlemen make up our editorial news bureau staff of the Philadelphia Trumpet Magazine and the Trumpet.com website. I have here in the studio with me Jeremiah Jacques, who covers Asia.
Great to be here.
Brent Noctegal, who follows the Middle East region.
Hello.
Anthony Chibarwe, who is going to be bringing us up to speed with what's going on in Africa today. And Richard Palmer via Skype, via the News Bureau in the UK. And I would also like to introduce our newest member of the team. He's a man who regularly contributes to our publications. He's a friend of mine. We went to college together. More recently, he's been working in the oil and gas industry down in Houston. So I'm happy to report that Andrew Miller has agreed to join our team today with us. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Rob.
This week, our top story, it's actually very disturbing on a whole lot of levels. Over the past 8 years or so, our leaders have continually told us that they're making the world a safer place. But as you will see, the exact opposite is actually happening. And to talk about this, I'm going to turn the mic over to Jeremiah. But first, Jeremiah, before we get into all that, why don't you just go ahead and give us a rundown over some of the other important stories out of Asia this week?
Okay, sure. Well, for the first time, Russian President Vladimir Putin has named both the United States and NATO as threats to Russian security. He published a new strategy paper saying as much this week, and this is just a really sobering sign of how sharply relations between Russia and the West have deteriorated in the last year or so, and just how dangerous things could become in the months ahead. And then we also have an update about the artificial islands there in the South China Sea that China has been building over the last year or so. These are seven different small islands that are being illegally built in waters that are in some cases as far as 800 miles from the Chinese mainland, well outside of what the UN says is their exclusive economic zone. And on Thursday, the Pentagon confirmed that three Chinese airplanes have now landed on these islands. These are artificial islands. They used to be submerged coral reefs, but they've dredged up sand, they've paved over them, they've built military installations on some of them, and now they're actually in use. Airplanes are landing there. And so this just shows that China is using these islands as military bases. It's gearing up to do that, and that could really threaten maritime security in that region. Officially, the United States denies China's claims to these islands, and it says these are international waters. Yet, last month, after we inadvertently flew a B-52 over one of the islands, we very meekly apologized for it. So what a missed opportunity to stand up to this just bullying behavior from China.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. And what was a big story this week?
Well, the big story is I'd like to try to build a little bit of suspense getting into this one. First of all, I'd like to read a United States presidential speech, just some excerpts from this, and see if you can fill in the blank. I'd like for the listeners just to see if they can fill in the blank with the correct nation that this the president is speaking about here. Good afternoon. I'm pleased that the United States and blank yesterday reached an agreement on the text of a framework document on blank's nuclear program. Under the agreement, blank has agreed to freeze its existing nuclear program and to accept international inspections of all existing facilities. This agreement does not rely on trust. Compliance will be certified by the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Oh, I know. Let me guess here. Iran.
Okay, well, if you answered Iran, you could not be faulted. Those statements sound eerily similar to speeches that President Barack Obama has made just last year about the deal that the U.S. reached with Iran. Yeah, it sounds very similar, but those statements were not about Iran. and they were not made by President Obama. They were actually about North Korea, and they were delivered by President Bill Clinton back in 1994, about a deal that his administration had just struck with the North Korean regime. So how did that go? Well, 12 years after President Clinton made those statements, North Korea detonated its first nuclear bomb, just a test. It was a small plutonium-based bomb. Then in 2009 and 2013, the North Koreans detonated two more plutonium-based bombs. And that brings us to this week. This week, January 5th, North Korea ratcheted up all of this illegal nuclear development behavior, brought it quite, you know, to a much higher level there by detonating what it claims was an actual hydrogen bomb. This is an exponentially more powerful weapon than the first three, if the claims are true. And the leader of North Korea there, Kim Jong-un, he said, "Let the world look up to the strong, self-reliant, nuclear-armed state," in a statement that he made shortly after the test. So it's just such belligerent behavior. This is in total violation of sanctions and international laws that have been placed on the North Korean regime there, because it has demonstrated itself to be an utterly lunatic regime. Intelligence officials are not yet sure if the bomb was indeed a full-fledged hydrogen device or not, but the explosions really shook the world still. It drew condemnation from all the Western powers, pretty much, from Japan, from South Korea.
Even China.
Yeah, even China and Russia, who are North Korea's staunchest allies, even they came out and said, "Calm down, what's happening here?" So a lot of people have really decried this illegal act, especially if it's a hydrogen weapon. The implications are really sobering. But what few people have called attention to is just the parallels between America's failed nuclear deal with North Korea, as evidenced by this illegal test, and the agreement that America more recently made with Iran over its nuclear program. So this is something that Mr. Stephen Fleury called attention to last summer in a really hard-hitting episode of the Trumpet Daily there. Just America's North Korea nuclear deal, that failed utterly. We have four nuclear tests now that have proven how utterly that failed. And that leaves very little cause for optimism regarding America's more recent nuclear deal with Iran, which is every bit as belligerent and angry, possibly much more so than the North Koreans.
Right, if it didn't work then, why do we think it's going to work this time? What's different about this?
Yeah, well, we are told that this time around, everything's going to be different. This time around, the deal guarantees that Iran can't develop nuclear weapons. President Obama assured us of this. Here's a little quote from a speech he made in July. He said, "This deal is not built on trust. It is built on verification." But isn't that almost word for word what President Clinton said back in 1994 about the North Korean deal? And hasn't Iran already provided ample evidence showing that it has no more respect for its deal with America than the North Koreans had for theirs? Well, I just think that this week's nuclear detonation there on the Korean Peninsula represents a glaring black eye for America's attempts to halt nuclear proliferation with deals, with these ineffective deals. It shows that when dealing with powers who are bent on destruction, diplomacy is an ineffective substitute for force. And I just think the question is, can Washington learn that truth from North Korea detonating bombs on North Korea, or will it take Iran detonating one in Israel or Europe or somewhere else?
Yeah, great question. And to me, it just shows how ineffective the inspections regime are, relying on these international bodies to conduct inspections. Now, where's the precedent that this has worked? You know, where is it? Definitely not North Korea.
Libya.
That's for sure.
Libya is the only place that it worked, with Muammar Gaddafi. He relinquished his nuclear program, but
right,
under
but then
threat.
What? But then what happened after?
Right.
He did relinquish it, but what's the world see? The world sees that X number of years later, he gave up his nuclear weapons, but here he got invaded by those same countries that convinced him to give up his nuclear weapons.
Right.
That doesn't sound like a good precedent
Yeah, and then the other place is Ukraine. We convinced them to give up their nuclear weapons. So they had the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world after the U.S. And Russia. And we said, hey, Ukraine, if you give them up, we're going to sign this Budapest memorandum with you that says if anybody ever invades your borders, we will defend you. You don't need nukes because America has your back.
But wait a minute, didn't they get invaded recently?
They did. They lost the Crimean
and nobody
Peninsula.
Protected them?
And the U.S. we just sort of tried to forget about that agreement that we signed. So our nuclear agreements, we really don't have a great track record with those.
Yep. And then now we have Iran, and I know, Brent, you're probably going to talk a little bit about this, developing ICBM technology. Here
right.
We have.
Every single week they come out with a new video of the new missile that they've been developing purely for shipping off or sending off nuclear weapons. And I would say there's even more proof against that this deal will work than the North Korean one. The North Koreans, they towed the line for a little bit. I mean, they signed the agreement in 94, like you said.
That's true.
And then it was, you know, they got a huge windfall, a lot of food, a lot of cash as well from the Americans. And then the next leader, Bush, even sent more money over and sanctions relief for North Korea. So they look like they were towing the line for a bit, where Iran, they haven't given any evidence that they are going to stop on their nuclear program.
So what you're saying is with North Korea, we had inspections, we gave them lots of money, lots of food, we tried to bribe them, bring them into the world community, and that didn't work. But here we are again, giving lots of sanction relief, providing, welcoming Iran into the international community, building them up, and we're expecting a different result, despite the fact that they still are indicating they're moving ahead with, like as you mentioned, ICBM technology.
Right. I believe that is the definition of insanity.
Insanity. Repeating, doing the same thing over and over again, yet expecting another result. Okay. Moving on here. Thank you, gentlemen, for that discussion. The Middle East. Lots going on in North Korea, but there's also a lot going on in the Middle East. So for that, let's go ahead and I'd like to turn the mic over to Brent. Brent, why don't you go ahead and begin by giving us a rundown of what's been going on in the region this week.
Well, it came out this week, reported by the AP, that the United States is okay with Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, not stepping down before March 2017. So we've harped on about this, how this was a red line for the United States, that Assad was going to have to leave. And yet with this agreement that was signed at the UN, he gets to stay there for a whole another year and a half before there will be free elections, supposedly, and he'll be removed at that point. Also this week, you had the Lebanese Shiite militant group Hezbollah attacking an Israeli armored vehicle, a roadside bomb over their northern border. It wasn't that effective. Nobody really died. But it was seen, even in Israel, as a weak sign from Hezbollah of their weakening strength along the Israeli northern border. We remember 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, there was that attack of the Israeli Air Force in Syria, and Hezbollah hero, Samir Kunda, he died in that. And the Hezbollah people, they were like, what's going to be our reaction? Israelis killed one of our top guys. What are we going to do? And they're so weak, all they could do was a roadside bomb in northern Israel where nothing happened. They're just embroiled in the Syrian civil war, and they're running out of power and manpower, at least for what they say is their main reason for being, attacking Israel.
Thank you for that, Brent. Let's go ahead and talk about your big story this week.
There was a number of articles in the Trumpet Weekly regarding this story, looking at it from different sides. And it relates to Saudi Arabia's actions in executing a convicted felon who was a Shiite cleric from eastern Saudi Arabia. He was arrested back in 2014 for actions of trying to foment division inside this country. Saudi Arabia is a Sunni state, and he is a Shiite cleric. I think there's about 10% of Saudi Arabia that are actually Shiites. And they put him to death because he was trying to lead insurrection against the government. This caused a big stir in Iran that he was executed, the main Shiite power. And they decided that they were going to, their police force was going to let revelers and rebels attack the Saudi Arabian embassy inside Tehran. So then it came back and forth, and again, and the governments were, yelling at one another for stirring up unrest and that type of thing. But what's been going on after that fact is there has been a lot of articles coming out about how there is a growing divide between Iran and their supporters, their Shiite allies, and this other Sunni group led by Saudi Arabia. And it's pretty interesting, I think, if we just look at why Saudi Arabia did this. I think there's a number of reasons of why they killed this guy, and it's not as simple as they just wanted to get back at Iran. Saudi Arabia is quite a large country, and they have to deal with their own internal struggles as well, trying to keep down a lot of their ultra-hardcore terrorists or hardcore Sunnis that believe that the government should be doing more to counter Iran. So the government tried to use this as a sign that, yes, we're not scared of Iran. We're willing to kill people that they, that they wouldn't want to be killed. So there's that element of it to try and show that they are strong enough to appease their own people. Yeah. And it's also probably trying to hide the fact that they killed at this same time over 40 Sunnis. Saudi Arabia did, executed their own people of their own religion who were Al-Qaeda terrorists. So they've got a lot of people in that same hardcore constituency inside Saudi Arabia that wouldn't want them dead as well. So they're probably trying to hide that fact. Also, what this did was it helped clarify the position of Sunni states and where their allegiances lied. We have to view this in the context of America looking to side with Iran over more and more in more and more arenas in the Middle East, and their longtime foe, America's longtime foe, Iran, now looks to be coming one of their friends. They're coming onto international governing bodies. They're involved in the peace process in Syria. They've got a nuclear deal with the world. So obviously they should be brought along. And this goal of the United States is just putting Saudi Arabia or making them more and more isolated. So what they wanted to do through this was to help the world see, probably Iran, see how many people were on their side. So after the Iranians stormed the Saudi Arabian embassies, you had this cascade of Sunni nations that cut off diplomatic ties with Iran, proving where their alliance lied, that being with Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia's leadership.
So after this execution, the Iranians, the public in Iran, they stormed the Saudi embassy, burnt it, destroyed it, and then that's the response that you're talking about here.
Right.
These other nations.
Right. All these other nations, including Bahrain, I think the UAE, even Sudan, African nation, they cut off ties. A lot of their diplomatic ties with Iran as well. So Saudi Arabia is showing itself to be a leader of the Sunni world. And that's important because, I mean, who are they going to turn to for help right now? We've talked a lot about how the United States is kind of withdrawn from the region, and this is very true. Because of their relationship that they wanted with Iran, they've just isolated Saudi Arabia. They've isolated the allies, so they have to band together somehow to try and come up against Iran. This wasn't the first act in Iranian-Saudi Arabian deterring relations. Over the past 3 or 4 years, we've seen them fight in the battlefields in Syria. We've seen them fight to try and contain Iran from infiltrating northern Saudi Arabia through proxies. We've seen Iran try and destroy the Sunni monarchy in Bahrain. And then we saw Iran in a very offensive war in Yemen. On all of those arenas, they're fighting against Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia just got their own back with this really small action.
Right. Now, some people have been saying that Saudi Arabia's recent actions are a sign of weakness, that they're panicking. What do you think?
Yeah, for sure they're panicking. This is all motivated out of fear. They fear that they no longer have a United States ally. They fear that with this nuclear deal and sanctions relief that's coming off probably next week, and they're going to have an extra $100 billion Iranians to export their jihadism and their reach for to be a global hegemon. At least inside the Middle East, and that's going to be at the expense of Saudi Arabia. They're scared. They're scrambling. They're trying to do whatever they can to find an alliance that will counter Iran.
Right, and all as a result of the United States' desire to disengage from the region. As it's leaving, it needs to come to terms with Iran. This is what you're talking about. And our traditional allies are afraid.
Yeah, they're afraid. Fearful. They're afraid, and it seems like even the it's that the American position is even going to become stronger in support of Iran. I mean, this past week, they've been starting to talk about all the human rights abuses of Saudi Arabia, which, I mean, wake up call. Saudi Arabia has been having human rights abuses for years, but they didn't think it was a big deal because they needed Saudi Arabia as an ally in the Middle East to counter Iran. Now you've got this American, excuse the bold terminology, but the propaganda machine that's cranking out all this hatred against Saudi Arabia so that the American public will gets side on with board the American with government. Yeah, and gets on board with this. Just look at the tally of who killed more people right. last year. The Iranians, here it is right here. They executed 850 people last year.
850.
Saudi Arabia executed 158. And yet we're not talking about Iran's human rights abuses because we want to deal with them. We're talking about Saudi Arabia's because they are, looks like it, the only one that's standing up against this deal.
And once again, big media complicit in the stories.
Oh yeah, watch for it. We said a year ago that this was going to happen. Watch for Saudi Arabia to, you know, look like they are the worst
be sidelined,
but the worst possible actor in the American media. Look for the government to change their alliance because they knew they couldn't have it both ways. You can't befriend Iran and then keep your friendship with Saudi Arabia.
Okay, lots going on. Thank you for all of that, Brent. For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to The Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review on KPCG.fm or 101.3 on the FM dial. We've been talking about North Korea's claim that it detonated a hydrogen bomb this week, and also about Saudi Arabia and the rebalancing that's going on in the Middle East. All these articles are in this week's Trumpet Weekly. It's a very informative, high-quality report that we produce each week. It contains the most significant stories and the best commentary from the very best sources that are available. I'd just like to encourage all of you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. If you don't do that already, just go ahead and log on to thetrumpet.com. Click on the subscribe tab at the top and become a subscriber. We'll be back shortly with news from Europe, Africa, and Anglo-America. And then after that, the lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Trumpet Hour with your host, Robert Morley, filling in for Joel Hilliker. You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world this past week. Let's go ahead and turn to Anglo-America. Andrew, what's been happening in the English-speaking world?
Yes, well, I think the first story we'll get into is, as of November, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration ruled that it's now legal to sell genetically engineered animals in American markets for food consumption. So now there's a company who hopefully in the next 2 years is trying to get genetically engineered salmon on the market. They've spliced them with eel genes, so they grow at twice the normal weight. Yeah, they're like salmon and eels genetically engineered together, grow twice the normal rate, putting on grocery store shelves here within months. At least as of now, labeling's voluntary. They don't actually have to tell you.
So they don't have to tell you that there's actual eel inside your salmon.
Yeah, like I said, unless something changes within the next year or so, they can have eel-spliced salmon with no warning whatsoever.
So is that going to be kosher then? Because salmon's a kosher fish, but now it has
eel
inside. Yeah,
that would be a big problem for anyone who follows Jewish dietary laws because it is now unclean.
I don't know any rabbis that would bless that.
Moving in the second story, we've also got a U.S. presidential candidate, Rand Paul, is really calling out President Obama this week for his latest round of executive actions on gun control. They haven't really gotten into many of the pros and cons as to far as what those executive actions would do to gun laws so much as he's just really lambasting him that he's just completely circumvented both Congress and the Constitution in passing them. These aren't just administrative laws as the head of executive branch telling his employees how to enforce the laws. He's actually created several new laws on background checks that he just snapped his fingers and the law has become being without actually having any congressional backing. I think Rand Paul's quote, which was pretty good, he said, "So it's important because if you allow the president the power to write law, basically you're setting a president up who can become a king and do whatever they want."
Yep, that's a danger in it, right? When you get away from the Constitution, then it's and who actually is making law versus who is executing law. Then we start getting into those dangers that the founding fathers were very worried about, right? Preventing tyrants from getting control. Thank you for that, Andrew. Let's go on. Tell us the big story out of Anglo-America this week.
I think the big story I wanted to address is the militiamen protest in Oregon. Now, to give a little background, there was a ranching family in the area, the Hammond family. I think they'd had some disputes with the federal government over the border between their ranch and a wildlife reserve for some time, and then they were doing a controlled burn on their ranch just to clear out some of the old brush, let new grass grow in for their cattle. The burn crossed the line and burned down 127 acres of federal wildlife reserve. Now, there's probably some local laws you could prosecute someone for that, for carelessness, even when the Bureau of Land Management does control burns, they very commonly get their fires out of control and burn private citizens' property.
Right, and not just the Bureau of Land Management, forestry, fishing game, like all these government agencies, many of them are involved with doing controlled burns, and sometimes they do get out of control, and they burn even thousands of acres.
Yeah, it's very easy to have happen, because the big thing here, though, is they didn't actually prosecute them under any local carelessness laws or whatever. They actually had the United States Department of Justice come in and prosecute them under terrorism law.
Terrorism.
Accusing them as an act of arson committed by a terrorist and mandating that you have to spend 5 years in a federal prison.
5 years in a federal prison for burning 130 acres.
Yeah, 130 acres of land.
Right, and was the Bureau of Land Management upset about, like they were very upset about
No, actually the Bureau of Land Management said that it actually even probably made the federal land more valuable, and that it burnt down some old trees, let some new grass grow, and the deer and local wildlife in the area have really loved it.
So it's actually improved the land. And it was comparatively a very small burn compared to what commonly happens when the government agencies themselves do controlled burns.
Yeah,
and they get out of control.
130 acres is nothing compared to what you'd normally do for at least several hundred thousands of acres of burns.
Yeah, and they get out of control too quite often, right, as well.
Because I know the local judge actually only gave the father 3 years prison and the son 1 year, because he realized that this wasn't really an act of terrorism, and he thought the 5 years was too steep. So they served their sentence, were released. Now the Justice Department...
That was the first judge who said
that was
this.
The first judge. Yep. The Justice Department's appealed it to the whatever appellate court.
So the Justice Department came out and said, that's not enough.
He said, no, it has to be
3 years.
There's a federal minimum that for an act of terrorism, you have to serve at least 5 years.
Wow.
So the 3 years wasn't good enough. So The Hammond family has really spoken out on the dangers of executive overreach, but they have peacefully accepted their sentence for the duration of the 5 years. Now, the Bundy family, which you may remember from a couple years back, they had their own standoff with the federal government down in the Southwest.
And I think this is important because these people have, like you said, peacefully accepted, you know, the judgment that came down from the courts. Because when you look at the media tends to paint, you know, these rancher radicals, these conservative radicals that are, you know, trying to defy the government. But in this case, with the family,
yeah,
that's
the actual
in question,
Hammond
they're
family
actually,
has
yeah.
not resisted in any means. Now, there is a militia movement led by the Bundy family that has come up to protest this. And even that, there has been no looting, no violence, no one's gotten hurt. Most of the people are armed, which is legal for them. So there's no breaking of laws, but as the media has portrayed it. But it is getting tense with kind of this armed militia movement that's at least doing a peaceful protest. And it actually even kind of ties back in with some of the comments Rand Paul was making. Candidate Rand Paul was making on executive overreach, where there is this growing awareness in America that the federal government has far extended the bounds allowed to it in the Constitution.
And that's the perspective of these people who are occupying the government
buildings.
That is the
perspective,
that's their perspective
of the occupiers, whether you agree with your tactics or you don't. But and they
right.
it's they definitely have the expective that the government's far increased past what the limits the founding fathers have placed on the executive branch. And so the across America in a lot of different ways, the situation is growing quite tense there between some of these movements looking back to the original intent of the Constitution and then some of the more like socialistic or progressive movements that are really trying to expand the federal government's power into across the nation.
So there really is this divide growing in this country today. And this militia movement is one of the outgrowths in response to what you just said of the growing of some of the more left socialist, big government type movements that are taking place in America as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much for that report, Andrew. Thanks for joining us today. Moving on now, we'll head over to Africa. It's a region that we don't cover all the time on Trumpet Hour, but for that, Anthony, I know you have a story that you want to bring us today.
Yes, Mr. Morley. Thank you very much for that. Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to help our listeners just appreciate this region, which is often neglected. So I want to help our listeners realize how important it is because in Africa, it's the one region where you actually see all the four pillars of prophecy that we talk about here on the Trumpet. You see them all happening in Africa. You see the rise of the King of the South. You see that in the northern parts of Africa, the emergence of Europe. You see that with Europe trying to intervene trying to curb the scourge of terrorism. And then you see the collapse of Anglo-America in Africa because they had a lot of colonies in Africa. And you also see the rise of the kings of the East, especially China. And
that's just an excellent point you make there, Anthony. And you, being from Africa, have firsthand experience
yes.
in some of this.
Yes, and I want to talk about Zimbabwe just real briefly. And it is a good indication of many other things that are happening in Africa, especially the collapse of the Anglo-America and the rise of China, because China is trying to fill the void that has been left by Anglo-America, specifically the United Kingdom, Britain, because Britain has a lot of influence in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe was a British colony, but then over the years, that influence has been waning, and you have seen China trying to take advantage of that. China is now Zimbabwe's largest trading partner. That used to be South Africa,
our next door neighbor. Right.
Yes. And now it's a country that's about 7,000 miles away. So China is trying to take advantage of that. It's just pumping in a lot of money, a lot of cash. It's given about $1 billion worth of loans to the Zimbabwean government. And in December, we just heard about China trying to push the yuan into Zimbabwe to make it one of the many currencies that are used in Zimbabwe. And it just so happened around the time when the IMF just accepted the yuan into its basket of reserve currencies. So China is taking advantage of it. It's trying to get more into Zimbabwe. It's just going to make Zimbabwean exports to China a lot cheaper for the Chinese. It's going to make tourism a lot easier for the Chinese. So you're going to see a lot of Chinese influence growing, and certainly they're going to try to take advantage of that.
Now, this would be a good thing for the people if some of that money, those billions of dollars that you're talking about, actually made it to, you know, the person on the street. Like, I know some people have complained about some of China's business practices.
Yes. China, when I've been there, I worked in the construction industries. When they come in, build their companies in Zimbabwe, most of the manpower is Chinese. So they are not...
They bring the Chinese laborers.
They're bringing the Chinese manpower into Zimbabwe. Whereas you had a lot of maybe foreigner companies that are helping the employment situation in Zimbabwe, the local employment situation in Zimbabwe. There was an article that we had in the Trumpet Weekly last week about some of Zimbabwe's laws regarding nationalizing foreign-owned companies. They have a law that 51% of any foreign company should be owned by local indigenous Zimbabweans. However, the Chinese are exempt from that. So you see, it's just this trend of Anglo-America being booted out of Africa, and you see a lot of Chinese influence in Africa, and they're just taking advantage of that. You know, China doesn't really care too much about human rights abuses, so that makes it easier for them to just step in, fill in the void, and it's all happening, and it's all possible because Anglo-America is out of the picture now.
Right, and China is able to buy its way into the continent, and we are seeing now much more competition in Africa. And we're seeing, as America pulls out, we're seeing other nations starting to vie for that area where the United States and the Anglo world, Britain in particular, has now vacated.
Yes. China is taking advantage. It's not stopping.
It is interesting that Zimbabwe is using the yuan more, and that China has pushed for that because, you know, here in the West, we're told constantly that, oh, don't worry about the Chinese yuan. It'll never be a reserve currency. You know, they don't have ambitions for that. They just want to be a part of the world economy. And here we are seeing, you know, here's a pretty blatant example of China saying, no, we want the same thing in the United States has. We want reserve currency status with that yuan. So very interesting to see what's going on in Africa. Just the one other thing I'd mention about that is just really sad what has happened to Zimbabwe over the last several decades. This was probably the most prosperous nation in Africa at one time in terms of living standards for people. The Rhodesian dollar was stronger than the U.S. dollar. And then it went through this terrible time period, that transition when the government came into power and just destroyed one of the most productive countries in the world. I mean, it was a food exporter to the continent. It provided, you know, it fed much of Africa. It exported its mineral wealth around Africa and around the world. And all that just dramatically fell apart in a few years. And it really was a terrible time period for the people of Zimbabwe. Anyway, Anthony, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your experiences with us. Swinging back to Europe, though, Richard, a big week in Europe this week. What's going on over there?
Well, we had the one-year anniversary of the Charlie Hebdo attacks that began the year of 2015. So there's been a lot of commemoration and talk about that in Europe. In France, perhaps most famously, the police were forced to shoot and kill a man who was wearing, it looks like he had a knife. He was wearing what looked like a suicide vest. I think it's been discovered now that it was, in fact, a fake suicide vest. There's still reports coming about exactly what was going on there, but you had yet another potential terrorist attack. Then, as usual, immigration was on the news a lot. So there were some statistics showing that the immigration migrants reaching Germany is not slowing, that migrants coming into Greece is not slowing. Germany said they registered 1.09 million refugees last year. Then you also had more, we talked a bit about it on Trumpet Week, but just Trumpet Hour last week, but just more of Sweden closing down their borders, restricting their border with Denmark. And then I think Denmark tightened their border control with Germany in response to that. So just more fragmentation in Europe, more borders going up everywhere. And then finally, Mr. Cameron has been off again around Europe trying to negotiate his opt-outs and his looser relationship that he wants Britain to have with the European Union.
Well, lots of things going on over there, Richard. That immigration crisis doesn't seem to be going away. Going forward, this is something that we're going to see a lot more of, you think?
Absolutely. I mean, Europe has not taken any effective measures really to stop migrants arriving in Europe. There was that story with some of the statistics from Turkey concluded that Europe's agreement that they made with Turkey towards the end of last year for Turkey to try and take care of this problem, they found that that had not changed a thing, that either Turkey wasn't or more likely Turkey couldn't fix the problem for Europe. So no steps that they've taken so far are going to help this at all.
Right. And this really relates to the big story you wanted to talk about today, ties in.
Yes, absolutely. There's been a huge story from Germany this week. We have a couple of articles related to that in the Trumpet Weekly, one of which is called Cologne Assaults, Police Reports Outline Chaotic and Shameful New Year's Eve. and they all relate to what happened on New Year's Eve in Germany. Now, I did talk about this at more length on the Trumpet Daily radio show earlier, but it's such an important story that we just can't afford to leave it out of our review of what went on during the week in Germany. So just to give some background, there's really two important aspects of this story. The first is just is what happened. The absolutely shocking and outrageous incident itself, which was basically this mass mob sexual assault of women at Cologne train station. So women coming in and out of this train station had to run what police said was the gauntlet through a mass of drunken men in a way you can't describe. These men were grabbing at them. They were groping them. There were some women that were raped. There was a huge level of, it was a 1,000 strong mob, huge level of crime, 150 crimes reported from that evening. Most of them, I think out of those 150, at least 110 were of reports of sexual assaults. One person talks about how they arrived at the station and saw countless weeping women. So there was this mass attack in Cologne. And then it's turned out it wasn't just Cologne. Cologne was the worst, but you had a similar thing on the streets of Hamburg. You had attacks even in outside of Germany, in Helsinki and Zurich and Salzburg. So there was just this massive, widespread sexual attack by men that were described as being of Arab and North African looks. And it turns out, basically, by these new immigrants that are arriving in Germany. These were largely, as far as we can tell, largely asylum seekers arriving from places like Syria. So that's the first aspect. Then the second aspect that's really important here is how the authorities responded. And what is absolutely astounding about this is the next day, the Cologne police put out a report talking about how there'd been a joyful party atmosphere at this station and in Cologne. So there have been 150 reported crimes, and the police put out this statement saying there's a joyful party atmosphere. They try to completely ignore the problem. The media didn't report on the problem. This was Thursday night. You didn't really get reports in the mainstream German media until Monday. Later, one of the German public broadcasters, ARD, issued an apology because they tried to not cover this story. You know, the news media did not want to talk about it. So the police, they basically lied in their police report. The media tried to cover it up until they were... I mean, this was on such a big scale that the media couldn't conceal it. It was coming out through social media. Then there were websites that were willing to report on this, and so the mainstream media was forced, against their will, to write on what was going on here. And then even now, the government and government officials are saying, well, there's no evidence that migrants are involved, when actually there have been many reports and leaks from police and anonymous police officials talking to newspapers showing that there is a huge amount of evidence that this was recent migrants committing these crimes. So you have this cover-up. And then, just to make matters even worse, so you have a 1,000-strong mob in Cologne. You have all these other mobs across Germany. No one has been arrested. There were some that were arrested on the night. They were swiftly let go. The head of the local police union said he believes that nobody is going to get convicted for this. So those people got away with it. That 1,000-strong mob, they're not going to be punished. No one in there is going to be punished. Even if someone is, even if they catch one or two, you know, just a tiny, tiny minority. And so these are events that have really dominated the news from Germany, and they're going to have a huge impact.
Richard, this to me sounds like something that could fuel a lot of unrest in Germany. It seems like it's right in line with what you were talking about last week about dissatisfaction with Merkel and how people believe that Merkel has lied to them about just the numbers of immigrants that are coming to Germany. And one thing that really just sticks out to me is how the mainstream media, the MSM, as people call it, just how political it is. I know over here people think about that, and somehow they think that, well, our media over here is so political, but we can rely on foreign media a little better to be more objective. But from what you're telling me, they're just as bad as the media over here.
Yes, I think they may have better intentions. I think they have some of the same concerns that we do over at the Trumpet about the rise of the far right in Germany and the potential that's there of a backlash in Germany. But they're going about it by trying to cover it up, which is, you know, obviously it's going to do the exact opposite. And you're right, this is a situation that could just explode. I mean, look at, you know, how would you feel if you lived in Cologne and you knew that there was this 1,000-strong mob, that they did this, that they got away with it, that no one was punished, that everyone there was still around? That's going to build up into a huge strength of feeling. And you mentioned Angela Merkel, and it is going to build into a huge backlash against her. But it goes way beyond just Angela Merkel. Like you said, it's the media, which she has no control over. It's the police. And that's what we talked about on Trumpet Daily Radio, is that this could be a this could build to a backlash just against the whole kind of German establishment and way that they rule.
Right, and even against just multiculturalism itself and Germany's open attitude to migrants.
Absolutely, and we talked on this program in the lightning round about how we've seen Sweden change that, and this kind of thing was part of why Sweden changed its attitudes to borders. There was a rise of a brand new, some would say far right, I don't think that's fair, but a brand new right-wing party in Sweden because of this mass outbreak of rapes committed by people coming, migrants coming in from the Middle East.
Right.
We've seen it play out already.
Right. And, you know, I could see a lot of people wondering, you know, after events like this, is Islam at all compatible with European values? I'm just wondering, I could see a lot of people thinking, well, why is it that these migrants can come over here, that they come over here, and then once they're here, suddenly they can act this way, that so many of them are just so brazen. And they're willing to do that. I mean, thinking about, you know, the climate in some of these Muslim countries, Saudi Arabia, Syria before the civil war, it's not like those cultures over there, it seems like, you know, young men are running around raping people and sexually molesting and having big parties in the streets. But once they arrive in Europe, it's like something happens, something changes, and it's like they're liberated or freed or whatever it is.
I was watching a brief clip from I think it was Ezra Levant on this, he made the point that if they did that back in Syria, the parents of the girl that they molested would come and kill them.
Right.
And then there's also the religious element that there's a strain of Islam that says, well, unbelievers are fair game. You can do whatever you like to these women. It doesn't count. They don't count. We've talked about in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks and the other terrorist attacks that this is going to lead to a European backlash against Islam. And look at the scale of what went on here. 1,000 people, 150 reported crimes. This could have a backlash or cause a backlash against Islam of the same kind of magnitude as a terrorist attack. It's that big of a deal.
Certainly looks like this is the item to be watching in Europe as we go forward in 2016. Richard, thank you very much for coming in today. Appreciate that.
Yeah,
and looking forward to having you again next week. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription of our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories that we've been talking about today, they're all in there. But before we finish up for the day, we have our lightning round of important news from our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
You're listening to The Trumpet Hour, the week in review on kpcg.fm or 101.3 on the FM dial. It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. Jeremiah Jacques, go ahead and take it away.
Okay, well, it was revealed this week that a group of Chinese people have spent $500,000 to build a 12-story tall statue in a gaudy gold color of Chairman Mao, the late communist dictator of China, Mao Zedong, and his quest to turn China into a purely communistic state actually killed more people than Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin. Estimates say he's responsible for the death of 65 to 75 million people. just such a tragic history there. But this statue shows that the people of China still love this brutal dictator. There was also a poll recently conducted by NPR showing that Chinese people in general say Mao was 70% right in his rule and only 30% wrong. The president, Xi Jinping, has also given plenty of indications to show that he is nostalgic for the rule of Mao in some ways. So this is this rise of Mao worship, worship of the tyrant responsible for more deaths than any other tyrant in the 20th century, has some really sobering implications.
Okay, thank you, Jeremiah. Over to Brent.
Israel is girding itself for the possible collapse of the Palestinian Authority. This was reported this week in Haaretz, and also then the Times of Israel picked it up as well. And over the past 10 days, there has been a couple meetings of the security cabinet inside Israel with the prime minister thinking about how can we prop up the Palestinian Authority and what do we do in the event that it fails. Now, the Palestinian Authority, they're in charge of a lot of the social services inside the West Bank. They're also in charge of a lot of just the functioning of the day-to-day cities, Palestinian cities. They also do collaborate with Israel in security matters as well, and they have foiled a lot of attempted terrorist attacks. So what we've had over the past 3 months is the gradual growing hatred of the Palestinian people for their government that they see hasn't done enough to bring change for their own people, hasn't done enough to lead the fight against the Israelis as well. So this could be, if it collapses, this is going to be some serious... Israel is going to have to really figure out how they're going to look after all the Palestinian territories. It's a huge financial burden, but then also they're going to have to go in there with the Israeli military to try and keep the peace in some of these most dangerous areas. And I can see world public opinion turning against Israel even further if that's the case. So it's something to watch over the coming weeks, seeing if this Palestinian government actually collapses or not.
No-win situation there for Israel.
Right.
Okay, Mr. Andrew Miller.
Yes, so we're also pointing out that Goldman Sachs has downgraded its stock market outlook for this year because the energy earnings per share have been negative for over 12 months. That's actually the first time since they started keeping record in 1967 that energy earnings per share have been negative for a period that long. Obviously, 2014 saw a huge drop in oil prices. And then on top of that, Brent crude's fallen another 35% in 2015.
So oil prices taking a drag on the economy.
Yes.
Okay. Excellent. And over to Richard.
Cyber attack on Ukrainian power grid looks to some like an apocalyptic first. That's the headline of one of our articles in this week's Trumpet Weekly. There was a cyber attack on Ukraine's power grid. And this is something that cybersecurity experts have warned for a long time is a major threat, but we've not seen it demonstrated yet. But this was a cyber attack that took down power to hundreds of thousands of homes in Ukraine. So a major attack affecting a lot of people, all done by hacking. Like I said, it's a big deal because it's Ukraine. I think it looks like it could well have been Russia behind it. The real challenge is with cyber attacks like this, it's very hard to ever prove who did it. Even if it was traced back to computers in Russia, which would be very challenging in itself, to prove that Russia did it would be next to impossible, the government was behind it. So you've got that aspect of it and the rising tensions between Ukraine and Russia, but also just this demonstration now of the kind of damage that can be done through cyber attack. I'm working on an article for the next Trumpet print magazine about cyber warfare. And, you know, we kind of have in the back of our minds that there is this danger. I think none of us are really surprised to know that cyber attacks are possible. I think we all know that they're dangerous. But I was just blown away researching this article into how big a risk is out there, how vulnerable we really are. And I think we kind of assume that we're safe because we've not been hit by a massive cyber attack. But this just demonstrates very clearly that the potential is there and it can be very destructive.
Thank you, Richard. We are coming to the end of our program. I'm Robert Morley, today's Trumpet Hour radio host, filling in for Joel Hilliker. But don't worry, he will be back next week. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive your daily news and to just cut out all the clutter and to find out what is really most important. Send us your thoughts, questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_.com. Find us on Facebook and Google Plus. Just search Philadelphia Trumpet. Thanks to today's guests, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, Anthony Chibaraway, and Andrew Miller.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with some words of Bill Gross. He's one of the most influential, if not the most influential, bond trader alive today. Earlier this week, he described the economic situation this way. He said, "The Romans gave their plebeian citizens a day at the Colosseum, and the French royalty gave the bourgeoisie a piece of figurative cake. So it may be true to form that in the still prosperous, developed economies of 2016, we provide fantasy sports, cell phone game apps, sexting, and fast food to appease the masses, keep them occupied and distracted at all costs." He continues, "The 1%, in addition to the 99%, we'll need an extra dose of Xanax or additional slices of cake to cope in the next few decades. Let the games begin." So there we are. That's our world today. Dangerous days. Thank you all for joining us on Trumpet Hour. But there is great hope. And listening to us every week, we provide you that hope in the form of biblical prophecy and where this world is heading. Hope you've enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.